So I guess you would have all heard by now about the bombings in Manchester last Monday night. And as it is now with the 25-hour news cycle, most of the world's media have moved on to other things, but not around here. I've mentioned this before, I'm sure, but I live right smack in the middle between Manchester and Liverpool. Now, Liverpool's the home of the Merseyside Skeptics and the Skeptics with a K podcast, if you need a slightly obscure reference. Anyway, I'm not sitting here thanking the gods or the stars or the blind luck that I wasn't there that day at the arena that I've been to several times to see the likes of Iron Maiden and Tim Mitchin and so many others. Why would I be there that night? Until Monday, I didn't even know who Ariana Grande was, or why would I? I'm not a 12-year-old girl. What did cross my mind, though, was the significance of how close it was. Even though it's about 20 miles from my door, it's a bit silly, I know, 10 or 15 years ago, I had things exploding literally right next to me. But when you're sent to a place where that's a daily norm, you tend to accept it a little more. So in that sense, 20 miles is a long way away, but I'll get to the significance of that in a moment. Some time ago, before I was married to Andrea, I was seeing a Lebanese girl. Her parents would tell me about the wars and explosions and the terror that they would see out of their lounge room window. And they said they got used to it. To the point when it was this realization, the realization that they were used to this terror, this war, these explosions, day in, day out, outside of their front window, that turned to be the impetus for them immigrating to Australia, to the open arms of Australia, as it was then. Anyway, for me, I think it felt closer than 20 miles because Manchester is one train station away from me. I walk half a mile, get on a train, it's an express train, and it doesn't stop again until it gets to the Manchester Victoria Station, the station that shares the entrance to the arena, the station that was a part of the terrorist attack on a group of children. Okay, that's a bit of a blanket statement, maybe. There were, of course, adults there that night, but Ariana Grande's core audience is young teenage girls. This is what these pricks were targeting. And for whatever reason, these six fucks decided that was what they would target. And look, this wasn't a spur of the moment attack either, as we're beginning to find out. This was a major terror cell operating out of the Manchester area and the surrounding towns. Homes just down the road from me where I live right now were raided 2 miles away. This cell seems to be bigger than anyone had initially thought. Which reminds me, everyone is or was going apeshit asking why the police or MI5 hadn't done anything about this cell. It turns out some of these names were known to the intel community and there had been some intel on the actual bomber and he had been back and forward to the Middle East very recently, within days of the attack, and his family had connections to some anti-Gaddafi organizations, all the stuff that we expect to hear. Except for the best that I can tell, and I don't have any insiders from the intel community helping me out here, so this is all from the media, but all the intel they had on this guy was 5 years old. Apart from his recent travel, which is not illegal, by the way, they had nothing on him. And that's because that's how these fuckers work. Well, for want of a better term, successful ones, that is. And this isn't a new tactic invented by terrorists. It's an old naval intelligence trick. Before an operation, for as long as you can, you go quiet. You go dark. If you're not on anyone's radar or horizon, it makes getting busted so much harder. The opposite is true, too. The operation in World War II on Singapore Harbour, where some Australians and some English sailed a fishing boat, a Japanese fishing boat, in plain sight, right into the Singapore harbour and took out most of the Japanese fleet, did so in plain sight. They were so convincing that on the way back to Australia, they encountered a Japanese patrol boat that completely ignored them. They did all this in plain sight. Anyway, let's stick for now to Manchester. On Tuesday, we were told that we now need to have soldiers on the streets with the police. And I got a little pissed off about this when I first heard that. I didn't want to see the streets of my hometown patrolled by the military, or not even militarized police. And this is hard to comprehend if you haven't lived it. And it took me a while to get used to it. But our police here in the UK are there as friendly and positive and an influential part of the community. They walk the streets, and I'm talking the suburbs too, not just in the cities and the towns. They walk the suburban streets, they get out, and they work in and with the community to make the area safe. It's not like in other places where they're armed to the hilt. It's not like some parts of America where disrespecting a policeman can and has seen people be shot in the back. Anyway, so I was a bit angry, and then I thought about it. I thought, we don't need soldiers on the street because we need to militarize the police or we need to move into martial law. It's because we just don't have enough police to do the basics of community policing, let alone when something like a terrorist attack happens. The government have stripped so much away from policing budgets that there was little option. The reason we needed to go from a terror threat level of severe to critical was not that another attack was imminent. It was because it's only when we're at that critical level can the government put military on our own streets. Which, if you ask me, is just fucking stupid. But in saying that, I don't want to see tanks and assault rifles and all the good shit we take to war on our streets. We aren't having firefights in the streets, so we don't need these weapons. A 9mm will do just fine. If we're going to have police and then the military on the streets, we need to find the balance of them looking imposing and them looking like they're there to help us, because that's what we want. And look, don't get me wrong. If that sounded like I'm a anti-police or anti-military thing, it's not. You know me better than that. I'm quite the opposite, actually. It's clear that we don't have enough police and intel staff to deal with everything that this country is going through. And you know we don't get to know everything. But the latest I heard today, obviously again via the media, was that the services, the police services, have 2,000 or so hard cases they're investigating right now, hard cases on anti-terrorism right now. And I think it was 20,000 or so soft cases and only a few hundred resources to manage it all. And that's a part of the reason things like Manchester and France and Berlin and all these attacks happen. See, the police, they have to stop every single attempt, every single one. But the terrorists, they only need to have one success. And that's the one we hear about, not the hundreds or thousands that the police and the intel community stop. And sometimes it's right that we don't know about it, because what you never do is give your enemy or the people you're investigating any idea of what you know. You don't want them to know what you know that they don't know. Anyway, I'll move on from this in a moment, but I just wanted to talk about the reaction from the people of Manchester and the surrounding areas. Now, as you would expect, there was a lot of anger about. I'm with them. And as we keep seeing, and we'll see this all around the world right now, and it's the first 12 or 24 hours, there's speculation, there's rumors, there's innuendo, there's all this stuff happening. And police don't want to reveal too much. They shouldn't reveal too much. So the population becomes self-appointed detectives, and the social medias go batshit. And then we get the revenge hate crimes. The mosque vandalized. There was one burned after this on Monday. Shops get firebombed, assaults, all the normal bullshit. And yes, this did happen in Manchester too, but not as bad as you would have thought. And not so much as the media will have you think either. So the headlines were all along the same thing. Hate crimes double, blah, blah, blah. But here's the thing. On Monday, there were 28 hate crimes reported in the Greater Manchester area. And of course, that's 28 too many. On Wednesday, there were 56. And again, 56 too many. But when you consider the area that the Greater Manchester police cover, given the rest of the population of the kingdom and in comparison to other industrialized countries around the planet, it's relatively low. And these statistics, these are all hate crimes, not just anti-Muslim hate crimes. Manchester's got a large Jewish community. They get their fair share of hate crimes. There's a large black community who get an exorbitant amount of hate crime. But again, I'll keep saying it, 56 is 56 too many. One is too many. But there was one report that pissed me off the most. This is what happened. One of the doctors, one of the NHS doctors that had just spent the past 48 hours in the hospital helping to save the lives of the victims of the bombing, was on his way back to do yet another extra shift when some fuckhead in a van pulls up beside him and yells out, and I apologize, but I'm quoting directly, the guy shouted out to him, "You brown packy bastard. Get back to your own country, you terrorist. We don't want you people here. Fuck off." Now, for the record, Dr. Yassin was born in the UK, grew up in Yorkshire, and now lives with his wife and kids in Manchester. Also for the record, the bomber was also born in the UK, in Manchester. The doctor said, in an interview with the Sunday Times, he said, "I can't take away the hatred he had for me because of my skin colour and the prejudice he has associated with this." He continued to say, "We Mancunians will rebuild. We will rebuild the fallen buildings, the broken lives and the social cohesion we once had." He said that while terrorism does not discriminate against race or religion, neither did the man who shouted at him. But if you need a little bit of hope that we're heading in the right direction when it comes to tolerance, maybe this will help. So the following day after the attack, the English Defence League decided they were going to descend on Manchester. Now, for those not from around these parts, the EDL are a group of fascists that like to pop up and demonstrate whenever there's been an incident where they think it's all due to the nation not being white enough. Americans, you can think of them as an English version of the KKK, but with less teeth. And much like the KKK, they are so confident that their opinions are the opinions of everybody else, they also cover their faces with masks. Some people call it cowardice. Anyway, they showed up at the Arndale Centre in Manchester. Now, that's got its own history when it comes to terror. Now, I don't think the EDL are smart enough to have known this or had ever been able to read a history book, but the Arndale Centre was the site of a terrorist attack 20 years ago when the cowards in the IRA set off a 3,300-pound bomb. Anyway, last week, the EDL decided they were coming to Manchester to be cunts. And I'm very proud to say that Manchester wasn't having it. I'll link to the Reuters footage where you can hear a local lad shouting down the EDL over the police. He told them, "The people of Manchester don't stand with your xenophobia and racism." He said, "The people in Manchester are going to stick together no matter what religion you follow, no matter what the colour of your skin. We're not going to stand with people like you. We're going to stick together because together we are stronger, and the people of Manchester are not going to be afraid of who is responsible for this violence." And as you can imagine, the crowd went wild. and the EDL pricks went home with their cowder's tails between their legs. And there are so many stories all about the good people doing good things in relation to this. People giving up space in their houses for strangers to stay. Taxis and buses taking people wherever they needed to get for free. People putting bags of food and drink on police cars, giving snacks to all the emergency workers, all the things that just makes a community a community. And as much as we need to remember the victims of this atrocity, and we will, but we can't forget how the vast majority of Manchester dealt with it, and how when at a time the community could have become horribly divided, they didn't. They came together and became stronger. And that, my friends, is how you beat terrorism. So we are, as I'm recording this, 9 days away from the UK general election. And if you haven't been playing along at home, this is the snap general election that Mrs. Mayby said on 6 different occasions that she wouldn't be calling. And then she did. Except that the rest of the world haven't heard much about either of the main parties or what their election priorities or promises are or will be. And that's not because we English like to be a little more subtle than the Americans, for example. No, it's not like that at all. It's because we here in the UK haven't heard it either. We're just the plebs. We don't get to know what's going through our betters' mind. All they want us to do is vote the same way that our fathers did, our grandfathers did, and our great-grandfathers did. But if we're lucky, someone from one of the parties will appear on one of the Sunday morning news shows and tell us what they've been told to tell us. But for the most part, we have the soundbites, slogans that Mrs. Mayby said we weren't going to get. So not only am I not joking when I say we have the choice between a giant douche and a turd sandwich, we really don't know what they really think because we're not allowed to ask them. I may not have told you this, the leaders of both the main parties have refused to go face-to-face in a debate, but they've agreed to answer questions from a live audience, albeit separately. But here's the thing. The questions all had to be pre-approved. And as it turns out, this is something that Mrs. Mayby insists of whenever she goes out to meet the so-called public, which aren't the public, but a bus full of her own supporters holding signs. It's pathetic. Now, the other parties, the minor parties, these are parties that will have 2, 3, 5, 10 seats at best, did have a live debate last week. And for what it's worth, it was okay. The highlight was when the Green Party leader said that they all needed to work together to form a coalition. And then he looked at the UKIP leader and very calmly said, well, apart from UKIP. And obviously that was the joke of the night. But apart from that, there was very little to learn and very little to gain because no matter what was said, these are the people that do not have any influence over the election or over the parliament once everything's decided. So even for the people that are going to not vote for one of the major parties, all that's going to happen when we go to the polls next week is that we'll be putting the X on the box next to the name that we don't even know, but we know it's the right one because it's got the logo of the party whose leader we think will be the least shit at running the country into the ground. And I'm 100% serious when I say that, and the parties know it. That's why there's been no campaigning in safe seats. Any other year, my mailbox is stuffed full of how to vote cards. You'll see placards up in the streets. Even the local papers will be full of the local Labour members' bullshit lies. But not this time. we've had absolutely nothing because for the last 100 years, a vast majority of this town has always voted the same way. So why bother campaigning? And I'm still getting asked who I think people should vote for or how to vote. And to be honest, I really don't think I can help because the parties are not being open and honest. Even now, we have the manifestos, they're all fairly standard, and we know the promises that are in them will not be kept. We know there's promises in the manifestos, even now, that once they're tested in the courts, will not be able to be implemented. So the only thing I can say is no matter who you vote for, and it's a decision you have to make for yourself, but you must vote. The only wasted vote is the one that you don't cast, especially when it comes to the so-called millennials. We know that the over 60s lean hard towards the Conservatives and they lean hard towards Brexit. And we also know that the under 30s lean very hard towards the progressive parties, mostly Labour, and they lean very hard towards remaining in the EU. But I think what we need to stop doing now and for the future is to stop voting as if we have a two-party system. We don't. It's not the Conservatives, the Tories, versus the Labour Party. There are 12 parties in this election. And of course, the not England countries have the parties that only run candidates in their own countries, like the SNP in Scotland. The Welsh and the Northern Irish have their own as well. But when it comes to the UK Parliament, the not England MPs have, for want of a better term, equal standing. Now, as far as the question of who I will be voting for, and I'm not even playing around now, I really do not know. Up until maybe a day or so ago, I thought, as did people much smarter than me, that the Tory party, the Conservatives, would suffer some losses, but only a very few. So the government would not change significantly, not in any real way anyway, come the 9th. But, and this is a big but, right now there's a very good chance that we may end up with a hung parliament. And if that happens, well, it's anyone's guess who will side with who to form a large enough coalition. I mean, it's pretty easy to speculate, and I have, and will again. I'm probably repeating what I've said many times over, but the ones that hold the real power when it comes to this election right now are the free folk up north of the wall, the Scots. They are essentially the third party, but they will never have the numbers to hold a majority by virtue of pure mathematics. There are 650 seats in the lower house, the House of Commons in the UK, and only 59 are sat on by the Scots. And look, there's nothing to stop the SNP from fielding candidates from the south. And I've offered Nicola Queen, the Scots, my sword. I honestly did. But she and the party politely declined my offer. And then we also have the traditional third party, who in 2010 did form a coalition with the Tories. They did have some numbers then, but for several reasons were made all but extinct in the 2015 elections. But here's the thing. If it's a hung parliament, it's going to be a tie between the Tories and the Labour Party. Nobody else has the numbers to even come close. But what they will then need to do, both parties will need to decide who to form a coalition with. They need to make up the numbers. Now, as it stands, the prediction is that the Tories, the Conservative Party, will be 16 seats short of a majority. That means they could find, if there's a party, a smaller party, with 16 or 17 or 18 seats, they could form the coalition with them. But this also means that the Labour Party, even though they're predicted to have under 280, they could then form a coalition with the Scots, who are predicted to have 50-plus seats, which will give them the majority, which will give them the government. And this is the situation all but with a different party, with the Liberal Democrats. In 2010, that albeit for just one seat, the Liberal Democrats or the Labor Party were short just one seat to enable them to form a coalition. But anyway, let's pretend that it gets as close. We don't have that big split. What will then need to happen is both parties will need to decide who to form that coalition with, which, no matter what happens, will give both parties a really big problem because they will both come with demands. And the main demand from the Lib Dems will be that second Brexit referendum. And from the side of the Scots, which are going to be the most likely party to be courted for a coalition, will be an independence referendum and also a second Brexit referendum. And of course, the leading party will need to give up cabinet positions to the party that they join together with. And look, to be fair, this is a right nightmare for all involved. So if either side were to partner up with the Scots, all hell will break loose. Essentially, there'll be a complete lame duck government for the next 5 years. And here's why. As you remember, the once United Kingdom is not a single country. It's England and Wales, Scotland and Ireland. And as much as the other countries have their own parliaments, they really don't get to do much for themselves. Essentially, all main laws are passed in the United Kingdom Parliament in England. And most MPs are English. So we have that thing that started many wars in the days of yore: taxation without representation, or Scottish laws being made in England by the English. Remember the uproar over the Trident program? It's never going to work out for anyone, not like this. But at the same time, the English will hate with absolute passion the Scots having any say over what happens. Let me see if I can put this in a slightly different context for the American listener. Let's say San Francisco, Fort Bragg, and Sacramento, all lovely cities, all different cities, but let's imagine they all decide that they were going to form some sort of political union separate from the rest of the United States. And for some reason, probably due to gerrymandering, the San Franciscans have more representatives than the other two combined. Well, that should be okay because there are several political parties, right? And they're basically, there's fair representation all around. That's it. Until the president of that union wants to build some, let's say, nuclear submarines. Now, there's no use building those subs in Sacramento. Submarines generally work much better in the ocean. And you don't want them in San Francisco because that will make the city a target for terrorism and hippies. So the San Franciscans and the Sacramentarians all agree that the new facility will be based in Fort Bragg. And that's all fair and democratic. And it's a bullshit numbers game where a city has no say in what happens there. Now imagine if those three cities were three countries. What if Canada brought in laws that only affected Americans living in America? Because that's exactly the problem here in the once United Kingdom. The English are making laws that are only affecting the other countries. So my point here is that when it comes down to a hung parliament, Mrs. Mabey or Mr. Corbyn have the same shit sandwich or giant douche choice that we have. So here's my prediction. Given the choice of tag teaming with the SNP, the Scots, or the Lib Democrats, well, let's put it this way. Does anyone really think Theresa May will want to share the Iron Throne with Nicola, Queen of Scots? No, of course not. I say she will try and form a coalition with the Liberal Democrats and flip-flop on the second referendum, which will inevitably cause yet more pandemonium and confusion and go on to further tear apart this once great Britain. Assuming that is that the Lib Dems get enough seats, which all decent predictions are saying they actually won't. And who knows, this election is going to be more uncertain and more chaotic than anything in my living history, that's for sure. And in the end, we will have a giant douche and or a turd sandwich and a very long line to the German immigration office. And all for why? Because David Cameron the pig fucker didn't have the balls to tell irrelevant Nigel Farage and his irrelevant party of fascists and bigots to fuck off. Instead, he wanted their votes. So he conceded. And the pig fucker who never wanted a referendum on leaving the European Union put it into the party manifesto to try to quiet the fascists down. Let's just see what happens next. I don't even know where to start with Trump this week. Obviously, the staff that stayed behind while Dum Dum did his world tour enjoyed the break, but it looks like the rest of the world saw him for what he really is. And look, I know there's a lot of chatter about Melania and Ivanka not covering their heads in Saudi Arabia, but I really don't care about that. But I think it's more poignant that the Saudis didn't care about it either. Them saying fuck all says a lot, as does the Saudis projecting Dum Dum's face on hotel walls and road signs and posters and all this bullshit welcoming him. The man who wanted to shut down Islam from America is being welcomed in that manner. This is proof that the Saudis don't care about tradition. They don't care about religion. They care about cock holstering. They will be saying things like, let's treat this orange fool like a king and he will give his arms deals. And of course, that's what's happened. Now, apart from that, have a look at any of the footage of Dum Dum in Saudi Arabia. When was the last time you saw a smile on his stupid face like that? But then when he went to Israel, things were different, well, a little different anyway. And he did make sure that he told all the media there at the end of a press conference that when he was giving away state secrets to the Russians, he didn't mention Israel. And this comes as a shock to everybody that was there because the press conference had finished and nobody had asked him. But that's not the strangest thing that happened there. So remember he went to the Western Wall? Did you notice what he was wearing? He wore a yarmulke. And look, I know there's been a lot of accusations of Dum Dum being anti-Semitic in the past. Personally, I really don't think that's the case. I'm not saying he's not racist or bigoted, but I don't think he's anti-Semitic. And that's not my point. Why obey the Jewish tradition and Catholic traditions when they went to the Vatican, when in Israel or the Vatican, but not when in Saudi Arabia? I think that question answers itself. But if you want to surmise the whole trip, this is the kicker. This is the comment of the trip. And it's a comment made by one of Dum Dum's own staff. And look, before I get to that, I should probably have mentioned when I was talking about the Manchester bombing that the intelligence that the UK had gathered and shared with the USA was, surprise, surprise, leaked to the media. And of course, Dum Dum is outraged and will personally look into this. But there's the thing. We all know that the White House is leaking like a sieve. And I reckon for every leak, there's a handful, if not more, leakers. And they are all getting paid for this, I assume. But here's the thing. What happens when supply outstrips demand? Either the flow will stop, or it will be like an outlet mall. Rather than paying a few grand for a page two story, it will be a few dollars. Maybe it will get to the stage where to make some money, the sieves will create bedlam. And I don't mean make false stories. I mean trick Dum Dum into doing something stupid so they can leak that to the media so they can get paid first. Who knows? These are modern day problems that are inconceivable when it comes to any other politician. Anyway, back to my point. So a source from within the Orange House has said that Dum Dum, whilst in Europe, acted, in their words, like a drunk tourist. And look, we saw it too, didn't we? Pushing his way around, always getting himself in the front and center of the photos, trying to get all macho with his aggressive, dominant handshake, insisting on a golf cart to take him 700 yards while everybody else walked. Drunk tourist is about the best analogy I've ever heard. And it didn't go unnoticed, and it couldn't have gone more wrong for him, to the point where the German Chancellor Angela Merkel said that the traditional Western allegiance is threatened by the new US presidency and Brexit. She said, the times in which we can fully count on others are somewhat over. She said, we Europeans must really take our destiny into our own hands. And she's 100% correct. But Dum Dum can't and won't be insulted like this. So he put together a very strong and aggressive retort on Twitter saying, we have a massive, in capitals, trade deficit with Germany. Plus, they pay far less than they should on NATO and military. Very bad for US. This will change. Yes, because there are so many Chevys and Ford Pintos driving around Berlin right now, Dum Dum. Do you think the fuckers that are driving around the USA in a Mercedes or a BMW will care if you put a tariff on it? Do you actually fucking understand how international trade works or price elasticity of demand? Have you ever actually read a book on business, Donald Trump? Here's the real problem. Here's the thing that the president of the USA has just started. And we can only assume at the instruction of Vlad the Putin. He has started to pave the way for America to withdraw out of NATO. And it's no secret that he's been wanting to do this ever since Vlad told him he wanted to do it. That's why he made a right prick of himself at the summit. That's why all the other world leaders literally snickered like schoolgirls during his speech, because they know something that Dum Dum is just too thick to realize. The only thing that's stopping an actual invasion of the USA is NATO. And sure, the USA has a kick-ass military, but have you ever noticed that when America goes somewhere, NATO countries go there too? That's because of this little thing called Article 5. Essentially, it's the if you fuck with one of us, you fuck with all of us clause. It was first enacted, believe it or not, after 9/11, and it's been used a few times after that. For instance, in the Russia-Ukraine conflict and in Syria, coincidentally. And yet Dum Dum wonders why Putin wants NATO shut down. Here's the thing. Just imagine this scenario. What happens if the USA pull out of NATO? NATO won't cease to exist. But for America, Article 5 will. Then what? Like I say, the US military is awesome. But so is Russia's and China's and Turkey's. There is a very high chance that we will get to a point where for the pure fact that Dum Dum is diplomatically retarded, he will have severed all the ties that he has with his allies, leaving the USA as a sitting duck. And I'm no great military strategist, but think of it. China striking from the Pacific, Russia from the Atlantic, Canada will be saying, fuck you, you non-NATO dumbass. And Mexico will be sitting on the wall like spectators at the sports ball. Okay, maybe that's just a little far-fetched. But have you ever been to Russia? It's bleak and it's cold. And I wonder if Mar-a-Lago will become the summer Kremlin. And like I say, far-fetched. But who will have thought in 1945 that France and Germany would not only become the economical stabilizers for the planet, but the political stabilizers too. Actually, scrap that. Who would have thought that 2 years ago that the once free world would be ruled by a man-child reality TV show host with the attention span of a commercial break who is about to send his country to war.
Hi, this is a voiceover robot. If you want to have each new podcast delivered as soon as it's released, go to skepticsmashtalk.com and subscribe.
Okay, I'm going to do this next part very quickly, maybe. And I wasn't going to bring it up at all, but I sort of feel I need to, based on my recent comments about that little corner of the skeptical community that feel that skepticism is all about pulling apart scientific papers and jacking off the p-values and pretending to be for equality whilst treating everybody with penis deficit disorder as second class. And of course, I'm talking about the Skeptic Society, Skeptic Magazine, where two people who I once held in relatively high regard tried to pull off a hoax that not only failed, but in attempting this, did the exact thing that this particular group of skeptics attack everyone else for doing. And look, I'm not going to go over it bit by bit, page by page, and pull it all apart. This has been done enough and by much better orators than myself. And if you haven't heard it, have a listen to Eli Bosnick. He did a breakdown on Serious Inquiries with Thomas, and Thomas actually did a second part that came out today, and they both did a brilliant job. So listen to them. The thing I want to talk about, though, well, the two things, is an assertion that I've made before, and this is something that Andy has noticed and something that she's challenged me on. And I've talked about this recently, so I'm not going to get into it all over again, but the comments about the reverence that the skeptic community hold for that certain cadre in the community, it's just so fucking ironic. We hold them up as if they're deities. But when you bring it up, the community turns like month-old milk. Like I said, I've talked about this before, but just for at least one more time, it's a reminder of how easily we can fall into the same traps that we accuse the people we somehow feel we're far superior to, because we can look at a scientific study and scoff at the lack of blinding or participant size or the journal's lack of credibility or its shitty impact factor. Like I said, Eli and Thomas do a brilliant job of breaking all this down, and the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe did a tackling of it as well. But if this was a chiropractor or a homeopathy hoax, they would have been on it like Eli Bosnick on a dick and fart joke. But at least they were honest. So go and have a listen to what they've got to say also. But for me, this is what happened, just this. The publication and the stalwarts that should be the shining beacon of excellence in skepticism and the skeptical community had a preconceived agenda or a preconceived outcome, and they come up with their results before they did their experiment. And you can decide for yourself what that was, the preconception, that is. But for me, it's pretty evident they wanted to trash gender studies for whatever reason. I don't know. Well, I have my suspicions, but I don't know. But look, you decide for yourself. Anyway, they had the outcome they were looking for, and in their minds, they got it. But they didn't. They did the exact same thing these exact same people, this exact same group of people, have been trashing others for doing for decades. And let's forget about the content of the paper for now. To me, it's not relevant. But the first part of their hoax was to try and get a fake paper published in some sort of respected journal. So they wrote a heap of garbage and sent it to a bona fide publication, albeit a very low ranked one, but a bona fide one all the same. And as it should have been, it was rejected. Now, what they should have done is kept submitting to other bona fide journals until it slipped through the net. Fuck it. If it were me, I would have gone straight for the BMJ or the Lancet. Both of them have had to retract papers in the past. But if you want to show that the peer review process is bullshit, don't start at the bottom, start at the top. But no, they did what every scammer and every alt-med wackadoo and every failing academic and every fraud does. They go to a pay-to-publish journal. They have published their fake paper in the academic equivalent of a supermarket paparazzi magazine, and they think they have proven that not only is peer review broken, that the field of gender studies has been demolished, which on both counts is absolute bullshit. But here's the thing, and it's something no one is really focusing on, and they should. The perpetrators really have done little damage to themselves inside the community, especially while the likes of Sam Harris and Dawkins et al. Are supporting the article. And fuck it, I don't care how much hate I get for this, but anyone supporting or condoning this bullshit in the skeptical community is no different to Trump supporters supporting him every time he fucks up. In both cases, the followers don't have a mind of their own. But the real damage here is to the skeptical community itself. How do we hold ourselves up to be the keepers of ethical journalism and research and academics when this is going on? And let's be clear, these are not some clowns off the street that have decided to become rogue skeptics. These are well-known individuals that are linked with the person or persons that so many call the pillars of modern skepticism. Two of the four horsemen are supporting this bullshit. Michael Shermer, the person I held to the highest standards of honesty and integrity, published this shit in what was meant to be the bastion of truth, the Skeptics magazine. The damage that these pricks have done to the skeptical community will never be undone. And it makes me wonder if I want to ever call myself a skeptic again.